Welcome to the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast, a show dedicated to the artistry and science of sports field management and celebrating the groundskeepers who create those masterpieces. The Diamond Da Vinci's podcast is sponsored by Beacon Athletics, for over 67 years providing solutions for sports field managers.
On this edition of the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast, I am taking over and I'm going to science y'all up.
Oh my God, worlds are colliding. We'll finish up our high-low segment from our last show, which talked about growing turf on sand versus native soil root zones. We've covered water movement in the last show. We'll finish up today with nutrient management.
In our out-of-the-park interview, we're going to talk athletic turf wear tolerance, my favorite subject. We'll look at some new machines for testing wear and some of the cool stuff that's going on in turf breeding. All of this with Dr. John Sorokin from the University of Tennessee.
And in the Meteorology Minute, we'll look at the fall forecast across the country and also what prognosticators look at in order to make these long-range predictions.
All of that and more on this fabulously sciencey edition of the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast. Hello, everyone. I'm Paul Zawaska, your host for the... Wait a minute. I'm not Paul. I'm Teresa Beyer. I am the co-host and producer of the show, but I have taken over. And I am joined by my lovely and talented co-host, Mr. Paul Zawaska.
Apparently you noticed I worked on my hair this morning.
I was just trying to return the favor.
This just doesn't happen, you know.
I'm not surprised that that takes a lot of work.
A lot of teasing involved.
A lot of teasing involved. Good.
Good morning, everyone.
So today we're going to be hitting the science, but we're not going to hit it too hard. We want to keep this interesting and fun. But I do want to get a chance to talk to one of our university cohorts and kind of see what they're working on. What do we have coming up around the bend that we can start getting excited about? And so our out-of-the-park interview is going to be with Dr. Sorokin, and I think it's going to be a hoot. He gives a good presentation for anybody who's seen him before, and so we all know that he can talk the talk, and I think that's going to be fun.
Nobody told me there was a bend coming up.
It's a metaphorical bend, Paul.
Oh. Well, as long as it's not a fork.
No. You're going to lead me down another road, and we're not going to go down that road, Paul. Fork you, okay?
Okay. This is what happens when you turn over control.
This is what happens when you only have chocolate for breakfast. And that's right, folks. That's all he had for breakfast was chocolate.
And caramel.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about the caramel. My bad.
It was chocolate-coated caramel.
Well, let's hurry up and run into our high-low segment before Paul runs away without us again. So last time we talked a lot about the water movement in the different soil root zones or the different types of root zones, whether we were looking at soil or sand, and some of the pros and cons that you can get with both of those. You know, if you're looking to save water, you get a benefit in some ways from having a soil-based field. And if you're looking to have more precise water management, which in some ways can also help you save water, you know, you're looking at a sand-based field. There's good parts and bad parts, and depending on how you manage them, you can affect your budget. And I think the same is true for nutrient management on both of these root zones. Depending on the work you do and the amount of attention that you pay these guys, you can have smaller or larger budgets for either root zone. Do you agree or disagree, Paul?
Oh, absolutely. Especially with nutrients, because with the sand-based system, again, as we talked about in the last show, you know, you're talking about a very sterile growing medium mm-hmm. that can't hold on to nutrients. It moves a lot faster through there. It's going to require more frequent applications, albeit lighter. Costs are increased not just by the amount of nutrients you're putting down, but of course in man hours that you're using to have to constantly be applying
right.
these kind of things. So,
yeah.
So there is an increased cost, whether you like it or not, on a sand-based field.
Yep, absolutely. What would you say, and I know what I would say, but I'm just curious to see what you would say, is the major advantage nutrient-wise to having that sand-based field from a high perspective, from a Baltimore Orioles perspective?
Wow, that's a tough question. I'm not sure if there is an advantage, a total advantage to that. See, I see an advantage more on the native soil side because the window of opportunity of error is so much smaller on a sand-based field.
Even with the budget that you had in Baltimore and the manpower that you had in Baltimore, that didn't work for your advantage on the sand-based, nutrient-wise?
Well, nutrient-wise, it works for us, yes. But what I was about to say is...
Sorry.
Is, yeah, you have a smaller window of error. In other words, it doesn't take much to make a mistake on a sand-based field versus a native soil field where you have a much larger window. Things don't react as fast. Because you're not dealing with a sterile environment in native soil fields, you don't have to do things to the extreme sometimes to keep things going.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I that's a tough question for me to answer, I think. I can't think off the top of my head that there is that much greater advantage nutritionally. Certainly from a drainage standpoint, there's a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
but
yeah.
Nutritionally, and maybe you need to perk my brain because I haven't worked on a sand-based field in 15 years.
Or because you didn't eat breakfast.
Or because I didn't eat breakfast and I'm living off, I'm hopped up on chocolate.
Well, I guess coming from my side of things, because I did work on so many native soil fields, and now a lot of my consulting has to do with the sand-based fields. I see the advantage because it allows you to quickly tweak what you need based on your climate, or not climate, based on your local weather and based on your intermediate needs. So if I've got a client who's got a concert or who has a big tournament coming up, we can easily ramp up fertilization without having to look at keeping fertilization high during time periods when we don't have that stress or we don't have that wear. So we can micromanage that nutrition to give us precisely what we need when we need it. Because I if it's June and we've got a major wear event, we are going to want to be sure that we've got more nutrition down on that field. But only for that event and only for that event recovery. We don't want it the 2 weeks prior to that. We don't want it for 4 weeks after that when we start heading into some major Pythium time.
But who says you can't do that on a native soil field?
You can. It's just, I find it's a little more difficult to tweak that.
I don't know if I agree with that. I mean, if you're looking at foliar applied versus... Mm-hmm. Because foliar applied is not going to last as long as a granularly applied.
Yeah.
So if you're looking at short-term tweaking, like you're talking about, I think you can do that on either one very, very effectively.
Now, if you're doing a foliar application of one of the three major nutrients, N, P, or K, you are looking at multiple applications on an almost daily basis in order to give the grass precisely what it needs. Because there's just only so much nutrition that we can get in through the leaf. But like you're saying, it does allow you that option, and then you do have that buffer on either side. So you're right. If you're in a high management situation, you can easily make that work for you.
Right.
Do you think that that kind of micromanagement of the nutrition has a place in low budget fields?
Probably not.
No.
Low budget fields, you're looking at a pretty... low budget fields, first of all, you're lucky if you've got enough to apply twice a year.
Yeah.
Much less once a year, depending on the situation. So you're just happy to get down maybe a late spring and an early fall application of fertilizer to get your fields through. And in a lot of, you can look at schools. There's a lot of schools that don't put anything down.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're just... you're letting the wind take
winging a prayer.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
By the seat of your pants. But I think in most cases, I think most low maintenance places are, they're looking at one or two applications a year. They're not even going to think about that kind of stuff. When you're looking at park and recs and schools or youth, youth leagues or things like that. That's what you're looking at. So you're not even going to bother with special. First of all, in most cases, they don't have the right people in line there to understand what to do to manage those things. And I'm not talking them down. I'm just saying that they just don't have that there unless they're getting some really good information from their fertilizer suppliers, which
or extension agent, or if they've got somebody hired to help them with that. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Or a consultant such as yourself, you know, that's the only way they're even going to know to do that. So,
right. Yeah.
So, you know, I just don't think that's something you're typically going to see on the low end. Certainly on the high end, absolutely. You're going to see it in every situation.
And I think on the low budget side, you can absolutely successfully manage a field just a couple of times a year with fertilizer. The key, like you said, is having that extension agent, having that fertilizer salesman that you trust, who will help you make sure that you get what you need. Which actually leads me into my next question for you, Paul. I know how I would answer, but what do you think about soil testing and or tissue testing? Does that have a place in low budget management?
I think soil testing does. Tissue testing, probably not. Soil testing, yes. Just to get some type of base reading on what's going on, and especially if you're working with a supplier or the county extension or whoever, they're going to want that information so that they can make sure they're providing you the right information. So whether they conduct it or whether you do it yourself, I would say it's best to do that thing probably once every 2 to 3 years.
Yeah.
On the low budget side of it type of thing. As far as the leaf tissue, I think that's more at the mid and high level management areas where you're going to see more of that. Of course, we did that at the Orioles when I was there. But I've never done that at the Little League fields.
Yeah.
And, you know, keep in mind that for the low budget, low maintenance areas, you want to keep your fertility somewhat low because that, of course, takes away a lot of other stresses as well.
Yep.
Such as disease issues. So.
And that's exactly why I would recommend that soil testing, is to make sure you're not overdoing it.
Sure.
Yeah, because that's exactly where you start to run into that problem. If you're trying to maintain a low budget, you've got to see that your turf is kept lean and mean. It has just enough to do what it needs to do to survive and to thrive, but not so much that it's overfed and becomes a disease smorgaseboard. But again,
remember, they're only going to apply once or twice a year, so it's not hard to be lean and mean in that situation.
Right. Well, depending on your soil type. If you've got a really nice clay loam, or if you've got a thick clay, you can easily over-apply, even just applying once a year.
Or worse, you could apply at the wrong time of the year.
Right.
You know, somebody might not be thinking and put it down just before the heat of the season or right in the middle of the heat of the season.
Yeah.
Not knowing what the heck they're doing to stress the plant out at that point.
And I've seen guys who are so used to working on a sand-based field try to manage a native soil field, and they just end up really blowing it because that's exactly what happens. It goes down at the wrong time of the year, or they overdo it for the type of soil that they have, and they end up having more issues than if they had just let it lie. Yeah.
Yeah, they tend to get over technical on a very low maintenance field, and it's a lot like when our industry went from the native soil fields in the 80s and 90s to the sand-based fields, and you had all these guys who were used to maintaining, myself included, maintaining native soil fields, and you were being humbled by these sand-based fields, which required a lot more care, a lot more diligence, you know, a lot more monitoring, and because that window of error, that window, you know, that margin for error is a lot smaller on a sand-based field than as a native soil field. Native soil field, you can make a lot of mistakes and get away with it, I hate to say it. And that's why people like Dan Douglas from the Redding Fighting Phils has never changed his field to a sand-based field. He'll take a native soil field any day over a sand-based field. You know, like he says, as long as you've got a good crown on that field and you've got good surface drainage, you don't need a sand-based field in most cases. So, you know, you get up to the high ends, the high professional ends, that's might be a different story. But, you know, he likes having that comfort. And he knows that it's going to keep his both his fertilizer cost down and his pesticide cost down.
Absolutely. So. Well, one thing I would caution for our listeners, if you've not taken a soil test before, contact your soil testing facility and make sure that you have them send you the literature or talk you through some of the steps that you take. It's not exceptionally complicated by any far stretch of the imagination. There are just a couple of things you got to watch out for to make sure that you're getting a proper sample. The other thing I would say is, if you are on a native soil field, you want to be sure that your testing facility is local. And by local, I mean within the state Or if your state has multiple soil zones and you're looking at a private facility that, you know, they're absolutely adept at working within all of those zones. If I'm coming from, I'll take my home state, Virginia. I want to be sure that I go through Virginia Tech because I know that they're used to all of those soil zones and that they have a strong turf department. And so their recommendations on those soil samples on a native soil field are going to be much more accurate in a lot of ways than if I had sent them off to someplace else in a different state. Which isn't to say that those other facilities can't do a good job, but if you're not familiar with the process, if you're not familiar with the type of data that you're going to receive back, this is your fastest and best way to make sure that you're going to get data that's most relevant to you that you have to do very little thinking about, which will just make your life a lot easier. Yeah.
Right.
And that's high or low budget. You know, if you're just not used to it, try something. Right. Yeah.
And I think it's pretty safe to say that most state colleges or universities have in their extension department a soil testing facility. Wouldn't you agree?
They all have a soil testing facility. The strength of their turf department.
That would be the first place I'd test.
Yeah.
Or check.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be surprised if we couldn't find a link to put on our show notes of how to properly take a soil sample for a fertility. And remember, when we're talking about soil testing here, there's a difference between soil testing for an infield soil and soil testing for your turf. You're talking about nutrient tests for your turf.
Correct.
Versus a physical properties for your infield soils.
Now, if you've never taken a soil test for your turf, you do want to be sure that you also pay for the physical properties test. You want to know what kind of soil you're working with.
Exactly.
Yeah. Making a little note here to put in that link for soil testing. And we'll be sure that we have that up for you. Some other time, if you guys are interested, we'll talk a lot more about tissue sampling, what it can and can't do for you, and how you can use it. Like Paul, I don't know that it has much place in a low-budget field, but I can see where there are some instances where it absolutely comes in handy. But it's not going to be as often as somebody who's got a high management zone. So,
and one of the reasons it's not going to be handy in a lot of cases in a native soil field is because in a lot of cases there are usually plenty of the minor nutrients for tissue testing purposes. Mm-hmm. That it's rare when you're low.
Yeah.
On one of the micronutrients in a native soil field. Again, because of that cation exchange capacity, it allows that soil to hold so many nutrients.
Oh yeah.
It's rare when you're low on those micros. It's usually the big three that you got to worry about.
Yep. So, all right. With that, let's head on over to our Out of the Park interview after a word from our sponsor.
The football seasons are kicking into gear, and Beacon has what you need to outfit your football and soccer fields for the fall season, be it team benches, goals, goalposts or goalpost padding, and flags. We also can design and supply soccer barrier and football end zone netting systems. When it comes to the field, we have the paints you'll need along with the machines to stripe them. We can also supply hash mark, numerical, and custom logo stencils to help you with your field artwork. Finish your fields off with yard markers, pylons, or corner flags, first down chains, and turf and track protection for bench areas and running track crossover areas. Beacon Athletics is your one-stop shop for all things soccer and football. We're just as much a fan of these sports as we are of baseball and softball. Call Beacon's staff of experienced sports fans at 800-747-5985, and we'll get you set up and underway for fall. If you miss our normal sales hours, remember that our web store at www.beaconathletics.com is open 24/7, 365 days a year to take your orders and get you underway.
Welcome back, guys. We're going to get started with our Out of the Park interview here. Today, we are talking with Dr. John Sorokin from the University of Tennessee. Dr. Sorokin, call you John?
Yes, oh, definitely.
John, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
We're doing pretty good, I assume. Paul, you doing okay?
We're glad to have you, John.
Great. Hey, Paul.
Hey. So I wanted to have Dr. Sorokin on with us because he's been doing a lot of really interesting and innovative work with athletic turf. And He doesn't just work with athletic turf, but some of his projects have been very strongly focused on it. And he's come up with his team at University of Tennessee. They've come up with some really innovative and new ideas about what it means to test turf grass for athletic purposes and, you know, the sorts of things that we can do to come up with better varieties and find different ways of approaching our agronomics and how we basically are looking at our turf. You know, there are a lot of professors out there doing that. John, I'm very familiar with your work because when I was doing my master's work with the Brinkman Traffic Simulator, you were doing a lot of work with the Katy Traffic Simulator. Where did you start your whole turf experience? Where did you do your undergrad and your grad work?
Well, I did all my education at Michigan State University. So I originally started off in the 2-year turf management program, the golf one. I wanted to be a golf course architect.
Oh, we won't hold that against you.
And yes, yeah, thank you. And when I was at Michigan State finishing my the 2-year program, and I knew I wanted to finish my degree, so I rolled into the bachelor's program at Michigan State. Is when the World Cup soccer got was in the U.S. in 1990, and one of the locations was the Pontiac Silverdome.
Oh, cool.
And growing up playing soccer, being a big soccer fan, Michigan State had the project to put the grass inside the Silverdome.
Oh, and
that's
cool.
That's where Trey Rogers, I got to go work for him and Dr. John Steyer.
Yeah, I remember
as an undergrad. Yeah, helping build the field and maintain it and install it for the World Cup soccer games. It was awesome.
Yeah, that was a big deal. I remember that.
That's amazing. That's like going to the World Series on your first day out.
Yeah, getting to see Brazil, the eventual champions, play, being right there on the field was pretty cool.
Oh, I bet.
So that was the thing that gave me the first, you know, being on the golf side of it, obviously being a big sports fan and playing a lot of sports growing up, you know, doing a project where we had to put grass inside the Silverdome with really low light and try to make it survive for 4 World Cup soccer events. It was the research that really sparked me. And that's what kind of made me want to change and go into graduate school.
Okay.
Which I did my master's and PhD at Michigan State, as well. And the reason I stayed there so long was I had the opportunity when John Steyer left to become the turf grass professor at the University of Wisconsin. I took over his technician spot for Trey Rogers.
Oh, great.
Oversaw all the, yeah, so I got to oversee all the sports turf research that was there.
Oh, that's really cool. That's a great experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't blame you for wanting to stay on for that.
Yes, so I got to go do a lot of fields in Spain and go down to Argentina and do a project for an indoor stadium. So it was pretty cool.
Oh, cool. So you've also built another new athletic field tester. It doesn't have quite the same goal in mind, but it's still kind of fun that you've been involved in two of these projects. Can you tell us a little bit about the TAFT, the T-A-F-T?
Yes. Well, TAFT stands for Tennessee Athletic Field Tester. So we give it the acronym TAFT, and it's kind of named after, it could be after the largest president in the history of the United States.
And that's what I thought it was.
Yeah, so just coincidence. So
there you go.
But yeah, it's called the Tennessee Athletic Field Tester. And when we established our Center for Athletic Field Safety at UT, Jim Brosnan and I, who's a colleague of mine, and we do a lot of the sports turf research together.
Yeah,
he and I. You know, we looked at what was out there for testing fields. You know, we do a lot of things like using the Clegg for surface hardness or the F355 on artificial turf. There's the Kanaway rotational device for testing traction or torque.
Oh, I guess. And that kind of allows you to pull on it in a circular motion to give you a data reading on how much force it takes. Am I right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, exactly. Yep. And then there's other traction devices out there, like Penn State has the Penn Foot, for instance.
And another really cool device.
Yes, it's really cool. And what it does is that you can put an actual shoe on, put it down on it puts the shoe down on the surface, and you put a load bearing on it, then it pulls, and it measures the resistance of that you know, foot being pulled across the grass.
So that allows you to look at cleat type and placement of the cleats on the shoe itself to see how that's affecting footing and safety for the athlete as well. Am I right?
Right, potentially. You
okay.
know, it's there, you can compare different how different shoes or something go react on different surfaces, for instance.
Cool.
So with sort of a traction measurement.
Yeah.
I guess, and then so when we came, we were thinking about brainstorming about what we can, what Taft would be. We had the vision of, because none of those have any correlation to actual human impacts, or so we can make inferences. This shoe gives more resistance than this shoe, so maybe it gives too much on, or doesn't give enough, for instance, with the pen foot.
Okay.
We wanted something that was going to be actual real world, and so the Taft isn't a traction device, it's more of it's an impact tester,
mm-hmm.
so kind of like what you would think of the Clegg. And what it is it's a machine that it with hydraulics it or air compressors, we can pound a foot down with different shoes on it to the surface and measure the vertical and horizontal impact forces that are being applied back to that foot.
That is so cool. And you guys have a paper coming out I saw it on PubMed. Is it going to be published in a medical journal as well as in a testing journal and an engineering journal?
Yeah, right now it's been published in ASTM.
Uh-huh.
So
that's the American Standards of Testing and Materials. That's an engineering level journal, right?
Yeah.
That's all about how it'll basically walk through all the different forces and measurements and data that it can take and how it should be put together properly. Am I right?
Right, exactly.
Okay.
So now that we've got that published there, we can start applying it to some biomechanics, kinesiology type journals is the goal, or sports engineering journals as methods for, or as part of our research data collection.
And on the team that developed the TAF, do you have, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Yeah. Well, the way it was developed was, you know, the publication shows that we took it to, again, the biomechanics lab, and we have data from our colleague, Dr. Songming Jiang, where they got different athletes running across the force plate, measuring the impact of the whole myriad of different athletes. We were able to calibrate Taft to do the same impact forces of a 35-pound athlete. So I always like to say little Marianne playing soccer.
Awesome.
All the way up to Bubba, 330 pounds playing football.
That's great.
And so it's pretty neat to look at it that way.
So you'll
we can actually do...
Oh, no, go ahead.
Real world applications. Yeah, so we can actually do impact forces of a, you know, we typically do like a 210-pound athlete or 95-kilogram mm-hmm. athlete, for instance.
Okay.
And look at different shoes. Yeah.
Oh, that's really cool. So the goal for the Taft then, is that meant to be more, are you looking at its, are you going to be pulling data that's relevant to turf grass wear itself? Or are you going to be pulling data that's more relevant to the athletes as part of your safety group?
Well, yeah, our whole focus is to kind of combine the two. Athletes,
okay.
Look at the athlete to surface interaction.
Mm-hmm.
And what is, so as a field becomes worn, or if you wear a certain type of shoe on this surface, how is it going to respond? How is it going to react for the athlete? And what are the changes that can occur as you know, say a Bermuda grass field goes from being 100% covered at the start of the field season to becoming worn throughout the end of the season? Does that change for the athlete to interaction to that surface? And how much does it change?
Now, have you done enough work with it yet where you, and I don't know if you want to even discuss this or not, where you can see it, any sort of difference between different turf grass types? You know, let's say ryegrass to bluegrass probably wouldn't be too different, but let's say Bermuda grass to bluegrass.
Definitely. Believe it or not, we've actually found differences in overseeding ryegrass rates and varieties.
Hmm.
So,
oh, cool.
That's interesting.
Precise. If you remember, do you remember the national championship game between Auburn and Oregon a few years ago? And
I wish I could say I did.
Okay, you have probably two teams that no one cares about, right? Tennessee guy.
If it's not Virginia Tech, I don't care. I'm kidding.
It's not Michigan State or Tennessee. No one. But what was, you know, in my opinion, what was great about that game was it was played in Phoenix, in the University of Phoenix Stadium, on overseeded Bermuda grass, and it was overseeded with perennial ryegrass at 24 pounds per 1,000 square feet, so really heavy overseeding rate. Mm-hmm. And during the game, this is as a turf guy, you know, this is the best thing you want to hear. It looked like the Oregon players were slipping more in their Nike shoes than the Auburn players are in their Under Armour shoes.
No way.
yeah, and that's what they said on TV.
I'm gonna go have to look up the footage. That's awesome.
Yeah, so for the first time, they didn't blame the field. Right? They were blaming the shoes. Because, you know, it seems like they always blame the field. No matter, it could be a perfect field. It's like, oh, man, these guys are slipping and sliding all over the place. Because it was a perfect field. And
that's amazing.
And so when you look at that game, you know, that was when Phil Knight, who I believe owns the University of Oregon, maybe, or has a lot of influence.
Practically,
yeah. But you know, he debuted a brand new pair of shoes, the Nike Alpha Vapor Ones, for the Oregon football players for that game. And I believe they tried them on the day before or the day of the game earlier on, when, you know, there's no one in the stadium, it's daytime in Phoenix, and so it's, you know, probably relatively high temperatures, no humidity, and they ran around on the field and they felt, you know, these shoes feel great, you know. Fast forward the clock to the game time, and you pack the stadium with 80,000 people, the air conditioning might be on or it's cooling or something.
Mm-hmm.
Condensation starts to settle, and all of a sudden dew starts to form on the ryegrass.
Oh, wow.
1,000 square feet, and the players start slipping because from the dry to the wet, they start slipping.
Huh. That's amazing.
You know, and it wasn't what was on the side of the shoe, the brand of the shoe. It was just, you know, maybe it was the wrong cleat for Mitch at that time.
Yeah.
And, Oregon not used to playing as much on overseeded ryegrass,
mm-hmm.
Bermuda grass fields. I guess they might play it when they play USC and some of those teams. But, no, those are arid climates that they don't play inside, but the condensation probably settles on those fields at night like it would in an indoor stadium.
Sure.
Yeah, versus
University of Phoenix was.
Yeah, and Auburn plays on overseeded Bermuda grass practically every game.
All the time,
yeah,
especially in the fall. And mm-hmm. being in a humid climate, they know what a wet surface would be. So they have that traction advantage, kind of.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so to make a long story short, we did some work for Pure Seed Testing that provided those varieties, and we got the Nike Alpha Vapor 1, and we seeded it at 12 pounds per 1,000 square feet, the ryegrass over Bermuda grass, and 24 pounds, just like they did for that game. And we looked at them with PAF, with that same shoe, with a 210-pound athlete. And what we found was the horizontal forces were not different. The horizontal forces were not different on the 12-pound, whether it was wet or dry.
Uh-huh.
But what we did find was the horizontal forces were different. When the field was seated at 24 pounds per 1,000 square feet, you had a lot more traction or greater horizontal force for the foot when it was dry. And as soon as it got wet, it dropped a lot, the force on the foot. And so that's where they were probably sliding when they practiced.
So all the old guys...
That we could find that.
Oh, that is so cool. So, mm-hmm. So all the old guys were right when they said that ryegrass was slippery.
Well, it's not the ryegrass that's slippery. No. It could be. But when it's wet, it is.
When it's wet, absolutely. Yeah.
Right. It's about the shoe. And that's the thing
that we
really want to emphasize is people are always saying the ryegrass is slippery, the field is slippery. Well, wear the right shoe.
Yeah.
You know, there's more than one, you know, component with that. You know how to run on it. Run, you know, differently.
So, John, do the shoe companies consult you guys much at all with your information?
We talk a little bit with them. Yes, mm-hmm. not a ton. I've had several conversations with Nike. I've talked with Adidas as well, and so we've done some conversations with them. But Yeah, we're going down that road some more, I think.
So that's something
we do a lot of shoe testing.
That's a burgeoning industry for you guys.
Yes. Yeah, we've done a lot of work with TAFT where we went to Dick's Sporting Goods and we said, what are your top 10 selling shoes you sell for football? And they showed us all the shoes, and from Nikes to mostly Nikes and the Under Armour and a couple of Adidas shoes. And we took those 10 shoes and we went and tested them on Bermuda grass, and we got some pretty cool data looking at them. We actually compared Bermuda grass to Kentucky bluegrass to a monofilament synthetic turf to a slit film synthetic turf. And we could see how these shoes all do differently on all the different surfaces.
Oh, cool.
And compare differently. And when you think of players getting hurt and injured, you know, don't blame the field as much as the other components that can go into it. An athlete can easily wear a shoe that gives too much grab.
Well, and ultimately that's the message it needs to get out to the media and to the public and that kind of thing, that for all these years it's been the groundskeeper that's blamed or something else in that fact, and when in fact it may be that the way the shoe's constructed.
Or it could be the amount of condensation on the grass. I mean, there's a lot of things that go into this. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
my opinion, slipping isn't as bad as too much grab.
I think you're right. Yeah.
Lines. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a reason hockey players don't have as many ACL injuries as athletes who play on natural grass or artificial fields. It's because their feet are sliding all the time.
That's a really good point. Really good point. No, and I remember doing some of my preliminary work at Virginia Tech. I was talking with some football players, and I actually had them out running on the field. I just wanted, it wasn't anything formal, it was very informal, but I wanted to collect some ideas from them to make sure that I was going in the right direction, and they agreed with you that they didn't like the fields where it felt like it was grabbing at them, and that was some of the problem that they had with some of the Bermuda grasses, is that some of them were so stoloniferous that they felt that they had too, like you said, too much traction, and it just didn't feel, they couldn't put it into the right terms, but to them it just didn't feel right, it didn't feel safe, they had a feeling that they were more likely to get injured.
Right. And then there's a fine line, because you don't want to be slipping too much.
Right.
You don't want to be that cornerback that your foot's slipping when you're trying to cover a receiver that's making a cut and you lose a step and he burns you for a touchdown. So
yeah,
we're trying to find that performance line. And that's kind of our goal of working, is trying to start doing, we're getting into human test subject data athletes and coming in running and doing performance characteristics on the different surfaces with different footwear under different conditions, wet or dry, Kentucky bluegrass or Bermuda grass.
Well, now, and Paul, you know this very well. You did a lot, you've done a lot of soil work. You know, infield soils are very similar to that. You want just the right amount of resistance and just the right amount of give on your infield soil. You know, you're looking for that balance. Right. In the soil side as much as we are now on the turf side. I think that's great.
Yeah, you're exactly correct.
Yeah. Well, groovy. Well, so speaking of that, you've been doing a lot of testing on some of the newer varieties that are coming out. I wish I knew more about this, to be honest. The last time I was looking at new varieties is when Riviera was first coming out, and Patriot was really starting to shine. We had great success with Patriot at Virginia Tech on our main football field, and we started doing some great testing with that. What are you looking at now? What's the new thing? What can you tell us about the latest and greatest, varieties that are coming out that you guys are testing for athletic wear?
Yeah. We've done a lot of Bermuda grass variety testing since I've been at UT back when we first started, I guess. I started here in 2002, and we really started testing it back 2004. And we did everything too. We looked at the Patriot and the Riviera, and the Riviera is still a really good variety. It's cold tolerant and it's a seeded type. So people that can, it's a different type of variety that people can use.
Yeah, it's not as expensive to get it established.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Weed control might be a little bit more of an issue initially, but there's a lot of products that you can use.
Yep.
But I think I always like to say, and this is, I always remember Dr. A.J. Powell, late Dr. A.J. Powell was saying, still nothing better than, you know, Tifway Bermuda grass.
He always said that.
It always seems like, and, you know, it was released in the late 50s or whatever, and still 60 years later or whatever, we're trying to find another Tifway Bermuda grass, it seems like. And we've, you know, in all the years we've been doing testing until recently, we've had varieties like Riviera that have shown to be just as well as Tifway, but nothing was ever better than Tifway Bermuda grass.
Good point.
So Riviera had better cold tolerance. But, you know, we've now done some testing in these last, I guess, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, we've had two varieties that actually performed better than Tifway Bermuda grass, significantly better as we increased wear with the Katy traffic simulator.
Wow.
And they're two vegetatively established ones out of Oklahoma State, where Riviera and Patriot both came from.
Yep.
So they have really good cold tolerance. And one is called Latitude 36.
Uh-huh.
And the other one is called Northbridge. You can tell by their names.
Northbridge, kind of, B-R-I?
Northbridge, yes. And these two varieties, from the get-go, outperformed all of the other varieties we compared it to, which was Tifway, Riviera, Hollywood, which was a seeded type that wasn't very good, but it showed some promise from NTAP trials, and then Patriot, which we've never seen. Patriot's always been, it always came in third in a two-horse race for us. I think that was the difference between the Brinkman and the Katy traffic simulator.
Well, and the Patriot, from what I remember, seems to be picky about its climate. Weather conditions. It seems to prefer slightly different, but for the life of me, I can't remember exactly what they were. We had good years and bad years with the Patriot, I guess is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, and I always think a Patriot would be a great grass for a driving range tee or a par 3 tee box, because it's so aggressive by stolen. It's always the first one, the best one to fill in.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all stoloniferous growth. And so what we find when we run the Katy traffic simulator over it is it toughs up and it pulls those in big chunks a lot more than the other grasses.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're mowing it, and that's why I think it'd be a better grass for a golf course, because you're mowing it at a tighter, shorter height.
Yep.
So that's not as much of an issue. But when you are going to create divots no matter what on a par 3 tee box or a driving range, you want something that's going to fill in really quick.
Yeah.
And that would be the one that would do it. I think that would be the best application for that variety.
I can totally see that.
Fields, it wears out pretty fast.
Yeah. Good point.
But these Latitude and Northbridge were the first two varieties that actually outdid Tifway Bermuda grass.
Well, can I ask?
We've got 2 years of data now.
Is the data visually striking? I mean, when you're overlooking your plots and they're randomly, you know, distributed, you don't know what they are, and, you know, they're blind to you. Can you look at them and go, yep, there's one, there's one, there's one? Or is it a tight finish? You know, is it a photo finish with the Tifway?
You could after between 15 and 25 games, you could go out and see the separation really
well.
Wow. So it
cool.
was not so much between those two varieties. So we're getting, that's being written up for publication right now.
Awesome. Oh, I can't wait to see that. That's really cool.
John, how far north can those newer varieties get?
As far north as you got any of the Bermuda grasses going now. They've got excellent cold tolerance, as good as Riviera and Patriot for sure. So,
that's great.
And I think the rewarding thing about doing the research is, you know, having that and application. You know, a lot of colleagues that I work with that do, you know, in research, they're measured by impact factors of the journals that they're doing in.
Yeah.
When we're doing sports turf thing, it's like my reward, my impact is it being used and helping people in the industry, in the field, in the real world.
Yep.
And this, the Latitude 36 from our research, you know, Tony Leonard with the Philadelphia Eagles came down to look at it. And
that's cool.
He's put in his stadium since then.
I'll have to talk to him about that.
Have switched to this variety. Because of the research we'd done here.
Oh, great.
Darren Daly with the Cincinnati Bengals put Latitude 36 in his practice fields.
Huh.
And the Kansas City Chiefs put in Northbridge. So that, and then Jess Salmon at Oklahoma just put in Latitude 36.
Oh, okay. Wow.
And And, you know, put how is that? Oklahoma putting in an Oklahoma State variety. So you know that it's got to be good. Also, Jeff Salmon's an excellent sports field manager. And
yes.
He uses research and the resources to do what's best. So, you know,
sure.
It just happens that his rival university developed a couple of phenomenal varieties that are excellent for sports fields and really are, you know, changing the game for us.
I remember when Mike Buchholter with the Phillies started playing around with the idea of Bermuda grass and thinking about it, and I'm still floored by the idea that Philadelphia, you know, he and Tony are using Bermuda grasses in different applications around town and in their own fields. Coming from the transition zone, the idea of putting Bermuda grass that far north still just makes me worry. But, you know, obviously these varieties can handle it. So that's really cool.
Yeah. Well, and you look at Purdue has Riviera Bermuda grass in their stadium.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So that's what they... Yeah, so that's pretty far north.
Yeah.
I would call that transition zone. They're on the edge of it.
Yeah. But, you know, the push has been in the past decade or so to get the Bermuda as far north as possible. So
yes.
My question is, are they continuing to work to push that even farther north, or do they think they've reached the limits they can really push it?
I'm thinking they're reaching the limit because you still need, Bert McCarty, Dr. McCarty at Clemson said, Bermuda grass needs 100 days of growth to really be successful.
Yeah.
And which means you need 100 days of good Bermuda grass weather. And
yeah.
The further north you go, you're not going to get that.
You're not going to get it. Absolutely. So. Yeah.
Now, I do know there is a golf course up in Washington State over near the Yakima Valley, I think, where they have, they blew me away. They were growing Bermuda grass out there. I was out there for another event for some other thing for a different job, and they were like, well, we're growing, and I can't remember what kind of Bermuda. I think it might have been, it wouldn't have been Riviera. I think it was something else. We're going blah 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 Bermuda, and I looked at the guy and I said, somebody give me a map, because I was trying to figure out where we were and how on earth they were getting enough weather. But it was near the Palouse region, which is well known for growing beans and peas and all of that. And so they get just enough warm weather most summers, you know, 9 out of 10 summers that they are able to pull it off. So that was really
wild.
Yeah,
and they can probably get hot enough summers that it survives, and their winters probably are mild enough that it survives the winters. It just goes dormant a lot sooner and takes a while to come back out of dormancy.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. The same thing with people up in northern Michigan have zoysia grass lawns at their cottages.
Yeah.
You know, it's really far north, but it doesn't start growing till June, and it's done by the end of August, early September. So they don't have to worry about going up and mowing their yard.
That's perfect.
It's perfect for a cabin. Yep.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Well, so you're not sorry, Paul.
So I was just going to say, so besides Bermuda grasses, you've also been playing with bluegrasses as well, correct?
Yes. We've looked at not so much individual varieties, but we've looked at blends and we've looked at different soil types. So we've looked at bluegrass going on a USGA spec versus the ASTM. STMA helped develop those ASTM standards, and no one's really compared how does it do compared to USGA spec.
Would you feel comfortable explaining?
I'd be comfortable.
Oh, I was just wondering, if you'd feel comfortable explaining the difference between the ASTM and the GCSAA. Standards.
The USGA specs. Yes.
Or USGA, sorry.
The USGA specs, you know, were developed starting in the 50s and evolved over time to, you know, meet a criteria that's going to make the best playing surface, most consistent playing surface across basically the country, the United States, whether you're in Seattle to Miami to Phoenix to, you know, Detroit or Chicago, of a well-drained putting green that is going to, you know, provide a good surface, and it has a well-graded soil, but most of this of the root zone, well-graded sand root zone, but they don't allow a lot of fines, and they don't allow a lot of coarse material, and it's mostly in that medium to coarse sand range.
Yeah.
But then there's some fines and very fine sands to lock it up.
Yeah.
And not a lot of silt plus clay, and definitely not a lot of coarse sand or very coarse sand or fine gravel, because you know you're mowing your grass at 2.5 to 3 millimeters, and you don't want
Right.
sand particles that are that size in there. So The ASTM specs allow for more fines, a greater percentage of fines, as well as a greater percentage of coarse and very coarse sands and almost in fine gravels. So it's an even more what we call well-graded sand root zone with,
yep,
from large-sized particles to smaller particles. And the concept is those smaller particles will lock in the void spaces of the larger particles. So adding a stable root zone, a firm root zone, but it's going to be very well drained.
That's awesome.
And you know that you don't mow your athletic field down to a putting green height, so you can have those coarser particles in there,
yep,
as well.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, we always used to joke that we didn't understand why we were playing football on a golf green.
On a putting green.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, we had to. We needed something, the drainage. But yeah, it's nice that there's a new, mm-hmm, standard out there.
Well, but you know, ironically, there's not any difference really between the two when we found them.
So no kidding.
It's, you know, and we've looked at them with bluegrass and with Bermudagrass comparing them. And we haven't. One of the challenges, unfortunately, is that it's really expensive to manufacture the ASTM ones because it's hard to find that kind of a sand existing in nature. So you're going to have it blended.
Mm-hmm.
And it might take multiple steps to blend it.
Oh, huh. Mm-hmm.
So it's been interesting along those lines. But getting back on the bluegrass,
yep,
you know, we've looked at bluegrasses. Probably the most interesting one was this last fall. We have the Kentucky Bluegrass NTEP trial, the National Turfgrass Evaluation Program.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like 100, we have it with traffic, and I believe there's about 110 entries in there.
Okay.
And we put 25 simulated games on it last fall, and I went out there, and more than I've ever seen on Bermuda grass separation, there's a variety that stood out there, and I'm like, what is that? And it's like, it's been trafficked where everything else was down to 60% cover, as low as 30 or 25% cover.
Wow.
And this one was just still almost, what is that? Because we were trafficking it in the fall, so it was continuing to grow as well.
Uh-huh.
And it had an experimental number, but I found out it's a variety by Barenbrug called Barrette.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's got a lighter green color to it. And I call it the kudzu of Kentucky bluegrass because it's so aggressive. It's grown 3/4 into the adjacent varieties next to it.
Wow.
Really?
So
wow.
It's unbelievable. Yeah.
Huh.
So, and it does well during our hot summers. It's so.
Of course, as a groundskeeper,
really
we're saying. As a groundskeeper saying, can't you get that thing darker?
Some,
yeah.
Well, some of the groundskeepers like the apple green color now, Paul.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess I always like to say green's better than brown. So
yeah.
This is true.
No matter what color green
doesn't
it is.
Matter
it's
what,
all
yeah, exactly, right. Right.
So, yeah. So as you were saying, Paul, earlier, you know, trying to push Bermuda grass further north, I think these bluegrasses can be pushing further south.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I agree.
If they get improved as well. And it just depends on what type of event you're using it. If you're not playing on it much in the summertime, you know, but you're doing fall and spring sports, you probably want something that's actively growing.
Mm-hmm.
That's
so
a good point.
These are something that's, you know, we got improvements in the breeding. It's fantastic what's going on with breeders looking at different things besides just color and obviously disease things, but now they're looking at things for drought and wear tolerance of grasses. So
that's what I was just going to ask. Are you guys providing data for the breeders during the breeding process yet? Is that something that the breeders are looking for, or are they still doing post-testing?
No, they definitely look at that. We you know, we work a lot with Fambika at Texas A&M, mm-hmm, on some of her bluegrass lines, and now we got a multi-state zoysia grass project we're doing looking at zoysia grasses, not so much for sports fields.
Right.
I did a lot of work with Dr. Hannah in Georgia and Tifton before he retired,
mm-hmm,
and now working with Brian Schwartz there. And we've done some work, and we did a lot showing that their Tif Grand variety did really well in sports turf. And they got a new one that was just released that we're working on now, that we've been working on, called Tif Tough. DT1, it's a drought tolerant one variety.
Oh, cool.
And it's showing some promise for sports fields as well. It's a really deep rooted grass, so a lot of root mass, so hopefully it can, you know, help add that anchoring system in a sand-based athletic field and have some recuperative potentials. So we're doing a lot there. And then obviously Dr. Wu, who developed Northbridge and Latitude 36, mm-hmm. is coming up to visit at the end of the month. And we're going to look at other potentials and things like that. So yeah, getting in early with the breeders is a lot of fun. And they're showing that interest for the sports turf, because there's a lot of athletic fields in the United States.
Yeah, there really are. And you know, when Riviera was first coming out, it came out with a couple of other varieties, and everyone was talking about how cold tolerant they were and how great they were going to be, and we could use them on sports fields. And we took the Brinkman to them, beat the heck out of them, mm-hmm. and turns out only one of them, only Riviera, was going to have any future in athletic fields.
Yeah.
The other ones just took a beating and never came back, and really, really struggled. And I think that was, you know, part of the impetus, plus the work that you guys were doing up in Michigan, and then even what Brosnan was doing when he was working on his grad degrees. You know, we were really mm-hmm. fortunate to have a bunch of us all of a sudden take a really strong interest in athletic wear tolerance, enough that I think we got a big push through the industry to start saying, hey, you guys, you need to start paying attention to us too. We matter.
Yeah. You know, and the challenge has always been funding, obviously, because, like I said, there's a lot of athletic fields, but 99% of them don't have a budget.
Yep.
Right.
And so,
right.
You know, it's not like golf has always driven everything. You know, it's been fun over the years to see that because of, the work that, Tracy, you did and we did as grad students, you know, pioneering a lot of this mm-hmm. to increase the awareness. And, you know, I like to say, let's get to the soccer moms and, you know, get them to start voicing it, because we're ultimately trying to make things better for their children playing on these fields. And,
yeah.
Let me ask you this, John.
What we do is more important.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. Do you get frustrated with the research that you're doing and the advancements that you guys are finding in wear tolerance and finding better varieties that can be very aggressive and repair faster or whatever, however you want to look at it? Do you find it unsettling seeing how quickly so many high school and colleges are turning over to artificial turf for not just their football fields now, but baseball and all these other fields? When you look at this and say, well, we're coming out with so much better stuff right now, does that frustrate you at all?
In some aspects, it can frustrate me, but it's more the system that frustrates me, is the decision making on doing things when there's nothing thought about. Well, we're just going to spend $1 million and put it in an artificial field without considering, we've never given more than $10,000 or $20,000 to look after a natural grass field.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
And so that kind of frustrates me in the aspect that, you know, well, if you put the resources towards natural fields as well, you know, most of you wouldn't be down this road having
right.
to go this way. But, I also understand that, you know, there's some instances where you have to have an artificial field
right,
on these
right.
multi-use
I understand that.
Fields and all of these things. So, but let's find that complement and do these things. I also think that the natural turf industry, you know, why doesn't, you know, I thought maybe a sod company that grows Latitude 36 or something and can install fields, say, you know what, for $1 million, I'll give you a new field every year for the next six or 8 years, the life of an artificial field.
Brilliant.
Right.
And we'll make sure that you have it. And, you can have it a natural field if you want it, or for yeah. whatever it would cost.
John, I've got a great idea for us to make a ton of money. We just need some land.
Yeah. Yes. But, you know, I think it's a culture we got to change from administrators in city parks and rec and schools to parents and everyday users, to make sure, you know, whether it's natural or artificial, everything is being, the resources are being put towards having what's the best option for that location. And they're putting the resources in. You know, if they can put in an artificial field, they should be able to put in some money to keep a natural gas field in a big complex where you have both, because it's too hot on that artificial field. And, you know, mm-hmm. my kids had games last Saturday, and it was like, wow, it was hot.
Yeah.
You know, but it's great in the fall, but it's, you know, but it's not in the
early spring. Yeah. So. Yeah. And that's what always worries me is, you know, kids out on these fields in the summertime and, you know, especially if it's a situation where it's an unsupervised type of thing and you get kids out there, because kids don't recognize symptoms for heat related
exhaustion,
you know, heat related illnesses. And, you know, that's one of my big fears with all this artificial turf that's going in. You know, there should be, you know, that those are things that really have to be taken seriously into account. Yes.
And that's happening a lot in several states. Utah, Kentucky, they're implementing, you know, you cannot use these fields if temperatures are at this point.
Good. Oh, I'm glad.
Things like that. So we actually published a model to predict surface temperatures of synthetic turf as well. So
great. Predict,
so taking atmospheric climatic data, light intensities, things like that. So trying to go along those lines, because that's a major issue.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Well, and you know, you have the same type of thing when you're trying to play baseball in early April and the ground's barely thawed, you know, and you're trying to play baseball up here, and you know, show me a ball player that loves to swing a bat when it's 32 degrees.
Yeah,
you know, you're getting a lot of vibration on that handle, baby, when you make connections, and it doesn't feel quite as good.
Yeah.
So, but
no,
you know, that's
I bet.
Right now, that's the nature of the beast. It's there's a mad dash to get as much in as possible, and you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens here down the line.
Yeah. Well, very good. Well, John, I don't want to take up too much of your time. I know you're essentially in college, so to speak. So it's the weekend for you. And
This has been a lot of fun. It's great catching up with you guys.
So. Oh, well, great. Well, I hope we get a chance to talk to you again. And I wish you the best of luck on your research this fall. And thank you so much. And we'll say goodbye for right now.
All right.
Thank you.
Sounds good. Take care.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks, Teresa.
Any good Diamond Da Vinci knows that late summer and fall are the best time to get your ball fields ready for next season. Take advantage of the normally dry fall weather to prepare your field and facility so it's close to opening day ready by the time winter sets in. Avoid those wet spring conditions that can back you up against an opening day deadline. Here at Beacon Athletics, we're ready for your fall projects, be it mound and home plate renovations, infield skin overhauls, or larger projects like new net backstops, outdoor batting cages, dugouts, padding, or other facility amenities. Beacon has the products and the expertise to guide you through product and design choices. We'll work to help you get the best you can for the budget you have to spend on the project. Call us at Beacon Athletics at 800-747-5985, where our staff of experts are waiting to help you prepare for next season right now. Don't put off till tomorrow what you can do today. Do it now to make your spring easier.
So, Paul, over and over and over again, all I hear is El Nino, El Nino, El Nino. And I got to tell you, part of me, because I live in Minnesota, is looking forward to it. I'm going to get a lot more fall this year, supposedly, than I normally get. And that sounds awesome. Paul?
Oh, we're back. Yeah. Right.
Nice. Thanks, yes. Paul.
Sorry, I was drifting off there.
Oh, my bad. Did all of our science go above your head?
Put my brain in a squeeze. Well, you know, of course, as you know, that's all we've heard people talking about for the past couple months is the growing El Nino out in the Pacific. And indeed, yes, it probably looks like it's going to be near historic, if not historic, levels out there. What's contributing to that? That's not something I'm going to cover.
I'm glad I brought it up then.
There's too many things that could get into that, but
no, that's a good point. There's a lot of stuff that goes into that.
Exactly. The truth be told is, yes, there is a very strong El Nino. Does that mean for certain we're going to have true El Nino effects from it? Probably not this fall, but certainly we typically see El Nino effects a little bit later as we get into winter.
Doesn't do me much good. I got roots I got to grow this fall.
Well, you'll still get the roots, you know, because the chances for a warm winter are very good up in the northern part of the country here. But, you know, there are things that occur with the El Nino that are also impacted by lots of other things going on. So you can't just say the El Nino is going to be the sole driver of the weather for the winter. Certainly it's going to play a huge part in it because of its strength, but there are lots of other things. The El Nino is one of the several oscillations that are looked at in the oceans around the world.
What's an oscillation, Paul?
What is an oscillation? An oscillation is
look
how
at you getting mad at me for getting all sciencey.
Yes, that's how temperatures over the sea surfaces change, and as the warm portions of the cold portions of water move around, they cause changes in the weather that affect the steering currents of or the jet stream of how the weather is steered.
Ah.
And some oscillations can last for long periods of time. In other words, it gets into one mode and it'll stay there for decades. For instance, the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, and that's called decadal because it typically lasts 20 to 30 years.
Oh.
It'll get into one pattern and it'll stay there for a long period of time. Then there are for instance, the El Nino, which can last anywhere from 6 to 18 months usually before it shifts. It shifts back and forth between a positive and a negative or a neutral. And then there's the Atlantic, not the Atlantic, the North Atlantic Oscillation or the Arctic Oscillation. Those are two separate ones, one over the Arctic, one over the North Atlantic, that change typically from, they can change from week to week if they want to. They're very short change oscillations. They move very quickly.
Are those the ones that drive the jet stream that we always see dipping down from Canada?
Very good, yes.
Or those, not dipping down from Canada, those, depending on what it's doing?
Yes, those ones, the Arctic and the North Atlantic oscillations will affect buckling in the jet stream, in the, especially in the wintertime, you know, depending on what phase they're in. Well, it was a couple of years ago, we were expecting to get a really big winter.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was 2 years ago in the Chicago area. They were expecting lots of snow, and the forecasts were all that way. And the North, the NAO, the North Atlantic Oscillation, never went into the phases that they thought was going to happen and create that buckling. So because of that, the jet stream kept fairly fast and moving weather systems very quickly because it was pretty much a straight east-west jet flow stream. So you didn't see the buckling that brings down the really cold air down to the south and brings those creates those larger snowstorm systems.
I see.
So when forecasters go out and they look at these big long-term forecasts, they have to look more globally at these oscillations and how all these different oscillations are going to affect each other because they all interact.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's many different combinations of how they react because they all have a positive stage, they all have a negative stage, and they all have a neutral stage. So what stage is each one of these in? Which way are they leaning? They have computer models, of course, that take care of trying to make those predictions. But it's not always an easy prediction. But I will say certainly that their predictions nowadays are way better than they were back when I was 30.
Yeah,
and it's really quite interesting. And I am going to put up on the website some links to some really good information on these kind of things so that people can read up on them and understand a little bit more. If you're a weather geek like I am, you really get into this stuff, and it's really interesting. But for the most part, you know, right now, for the fall at least, it looks like, you know, you were talking about wanting to grow some extra roots this fall.
Thinking hoping for a long fall.
Longer into the winter, the chances are what's going to happen is we will, especially up in where we are up here in the north, north central states, we'll probably get into a period of colder than normal temperatures for the month of November in that region.
Drat.
But soon after that, we will probably warm up from the effects of the El Nino or partial effects of the El Nino, depending on what the other oscillations, how they imping on that. The thing to remember is that we've been in an interesting blocking pattern for late last winter and all of this summer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's why we've seen so much rain dive through the middle portion of the country, through Illinois and Missouri and into the Ohio Valley. And those areas have gotten a lot of rain this summer, a lot of flooding early on. And that pattern, for the most part, has not changed yet.
Hmm.
It's still, for the most part, there.
So we'll be light on snow.
Yes, you'll be light on snow, but it could mean a colder than normal winter or a more normal winter versus what most people would think with an El Nino. So again, that's an impact that could change. I'm not saying that's going to happen. I'm just saying that's one of the many scenarios that could happen. And sometimes when something becomes very stagnant like that in weather, or persistent, as we say, sometimes you stick with the persistence in a forecast until you see it actually break down, just like when a drought comes in and you get a really persistent drought like 2012.
Right.
The typical forecast for persistence, you know, when you get a persistent pattern like that, is to stick with that persistence until it shows you that it changed. In other words,
there's a certain amount of energy required to move it into another. Yeah.
Right. Because like with a drought can build on itself because the ground gets so dry.
Yep.
As clouds come overhead, it can actually suck that moisture out of it before it can even condense and become a raindrop.
Yep.
Same thing with these larger oscillation patterns. If we get into a persistent pattern like we have been in the central part of this country this year, that blocking could potentially persist into the fall and block some of the effect of what that strong El Nino is going to do. I still think we're going to have a warmer than normal winter up here in the north. Certainly, we're all hoping that the El Nino does give California the relief that they need. Will it give them all the relief they need? That's hard to say.
If that rain doesn't fall the right way, it could just make things a lot worse up there over there.
It's going to be bad. They're going to have problems with mudslides no matter what this year. They have there's been a lot of fires across the West. Mm-hmm. That creates problems with lack of coverage of vegetation on the soil, which means things can move a lot easier.
Yeah.
And all those fresh hillsides that have had fresh fires, they're going to be kept an eye on for possible mudslides as heavier rains come in. But let's hope that that's what happens for the West. But we're looking at cooler than normal temperatures in the central part of the country for this fall. Hmm. Fall meaning September, October, November.
Mm-hmm.
But warmer on the southeast and up in the northwest parts of the states, and then we'll have to see how things change as we get into the winter forecast, which we'll bring back to you on this show as we get closer to that period of time. But I think we're all hoping that the southwest gets the rain that they're looking for. But again, I don't expect to see that until the stronger effects of El Nino come in later on as we get into November, late November and December. You're going to start seeing that, But I expect that it's going to be, because of all that rain, it will stay cooler than normal along that southern tier of states for a good chunk of this winter.
You know, if I were listening to you from anywhere in the rain belt that we've been, you know, where we've had all that rain this summer and everything that you just said, I would be thinking this is a really good year to put out preventative for snow mold.
That's probably true. Because, you know, that's the other thing you have to remember is that, you know, you can say, well, in the north here, you know, well, it's going to be warmer than normal. Does that mean we're not going to see any snow? No, that doesn't mean we're not going to see any snow. We'll still see our share of cold air come in.
Yeah.
It's just when you average it out over the length of the 3 months of meteorological winter, it's going to end up above normal. What that does tell me is there may be less of a chance of getting either any or any deep frost cover.
So we need snow mold protection too.
Absolutely, you do. you know, what that means is that you better start worrying about snow mold protection, because snow mold is at its worst when, Teresa?
When it is cold and slightly warmer in the soil and you have a nice pack of snow over top of it to help keep that warmth and moisture in.
Right. No frozen ground and a snow cover on top is the perfect recipe for a bad snow mold season. And that's a very good possibility this year in the northern regions. So make sure you're applying your snow mold applications as we get into November, December, and beyond.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it'll be different things in different parts of the country, but if you're in that high precipitation range in the Midwest or in the transition zone, you've got a higher risk this year. And if you're up here in the northern states, you're going to have a higher risk because we're not going, we have a higher risk of not freezing down as deeply as we normally do in our soil.
Right. Yeah. Right. All right.
That's, cool.
I think that pretty much wraps up our meteorology minute at this point in time.
Yeah. I think that's a good place to stop.
I would say that as I reach up into the Beacon Library here, that puts this show in the books. Be sure to tune in next time to Diamond Vinci's for more talk and ball field groundskeeping. And the best part is it's all free, you see, because that's the kind of bargain we're going to strike up for you, because let's just say we don't want Teresa taking over the show too many more times.
If you disagree with Paul and you want me to take over the show for good, please feel free to send in your emails or you can tweet us. Our official webpage for the show where you can send in a comment or an email is beaconathletics.com/podcast. There you'll find our show notes and all of the links that we talked about today. We also have our pictures and bios up there. If you don't know who we are and you think we're kind of funny sounding, you should see how we look. if you have any show ideas, we'd love to hear those too. We're always curious to see what our listeners are thinking about.
And may I add that if you listen to us on iTunes, we would love to have you review our show on iTunes. It's very easy to do, and it's so easy, Teresa can describe it to you, but, but we need those reviews, if you wouldn't mind, please. So pass that along to us. And if by chance you're a Twitter follower, our Twitter hand, Twitter handle is at Diamond Da Vinci's. That's at DiamondDaVincis. It's amazing how many people can't spell Da Vinci's. We're not crazy active there, but at least we'll try to share interesting things and links when we get a chance, and when we prepare our show notes, we'll send some interesting tidbits to you when we have the chance. That's just the kind of service we're going to strike up for you.
Absolutely. The Diamond Da Vinci's podcast is sponsored by Beacon Athletics for over 67 years, providing solutions for sports field managers. We'll see you next time, guys.
Lydia, that's all, folks.